welcome to the Lawyers Roundtable Show, where you learn how to get more clients, more profits, and more free time, all in 15 minutes or less. It's what you need to be the most effective and happy lawyer you can be, with your host, attorney and coach, Sonia Gallagher.
This is Coach Sonia Gallagher from TimeForLifeNow.com, and today, as part of our series of Lawyers as Change Agents, we have with us an attorney named Sonia Pressman Fuentes. Now, Sonia has been involved in women's rights since 1965. She joined the General Counsel's Office of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission as its very first woman attorney. She drafted one of the EEOC's earliest digests of legal interpretations, its first guidelines on pregnancy, and a number of the EEOC's initial landmark decisions. She was given an award for outstanding achievement at the EEOC. She's also a co-founder of the National Organization for Women, the Women's Equity Action League, and many other organizations. Her resume is just too long to mention, and I am just really proud and feel privileged to be able to share these minutes with her. Sonia, welcome to our show. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Sonia. It's a pleasure to be with you, and of course, a double pleasure to be speaking to somebody with the same first name as I
do. A beautiful name. So, Sonia, let's begin with your background. Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I was born in Berlin, Germany. My parents were Polish, and I had a brother 14 years my senior. And when I was somewhere past 5 years old, the family left Germany because of Hitler and the Nazis, and we moved to Antwerp, Belgium for a number of months. And then on May 1st, 1934, we landed in the United States. There's been a recent exciting development about that in my life. We came to the United States on a ship called the SS Western Land, which was a ship of the Red Star Line. And the Red Star Line brought millions of people from Antwerp and Europe to the United States and Canada. And a museum is going to be built. They recently had the groundbreaking. It'll be built in Antwerp to commemorate the Red Star Line, which operated from 1863 to 1934. We took the ship on the last year of that line's operation.
Wow.
And they're going to open this museum in the spring of 2012 in Antwerp, and they're going to have a permanent exhibit there about my family and me. And my niece and I hope to go to Antwerp to be present at the opening.
Oh, that's fantastic. Belgium is a beautiful country.
I've never been there since 1933-34.
Well, I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. What a phenomenal experience to have.
I'm very excited about it.
So you got to the United States, and since you were a child, did you always want to be an attorney?
No, not at all. I didn't really decide to be an attorney until shortly before I applied and went to law school, which was in 1954.
Mm-hmm. What was it that inspired you to become an attorney?
Well, it really, just about everything that happened in my life came together to take me in that direction. Mm-hmm. One of the things was that I grew up in the Catskill Mountains of New York State. My parents owned and ran a summer resort there for a number of years, and they used to invest in second mortgages, and they had a husband and wife team who were their lawyers. They were named Ethel and Joe Cooperman. So I had, as a child, the experience of knowing a woman lawyer. And that was certainly one influence on my going to law school. And another was that I always had a facility for language. And law, of course, calls upon oral and written facility. was another reason. And then lots of other things that happened. I took a course with a professor from Cornell's Law School and was very inspired by him. And I read Thomas Aquinas on natural law, and all of these things came together to move me in the direction of law.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how so many things in our lives push us in the direction that we should be going. And when we do find that direction, everything just flows. And it's great you're able to figure out that direction so early in life. So many attorneys and people...
It wasn't so early in life. I was 26 years old when I started law school.
Oh, but I can tell you that people way older than that still feel that they haven't really figured out their direction in life.
Well, I can understand that because mm-hmm. after I retired from my work as an attorney, I have gone in totally different directions. Mm. So you can do not only one thing in life, but many things.
Mm-hmm.
And different things are suitable for different stages.
So tell us a bit about your job, your position with the EEOC. How did that happen and what was that like?
Well, I started to work after I got out of law school in 1957. I moved to Washington, D.C. because I had a job there with the U.S. Department of Justice. I was in the Office of Alien Property. Mm-hmm. But because of various things that had happened to me in my life, I felt that there was something else that I was supposed to be doing, that there was something that my life was saved for and that I was supposed to do, but I didn't know what it was, but I was always looking for it. And so when I learned that there was a new agency called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which processed charges of employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin, and since then age and physical or mental disability has been added, when I learned about such an agency, I was interested in going to work there. And a friend of mine had as a law professor the guy who became the general counsel of the EEOC, and I applied to him for a position, and I was hired for the Office of the General Counsel. That was in 1965.
Wow, and you were the first woman attorney that worked there?
Not at the agency. I was the first woman attorney in the Office of the General Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other women in the agency.
And what was that like, being a woman attorney during that time?
Well, it was actually very difficult because the agency was created as a result of the civil rights movement, and it was created basically to handle employment discrimination cases for African Americans. And the prohibition against sex discrimination didn't really come into the act until the latter stages of the legislative debate, and no one was prepared for it, and no one knew how to interpret it, and no one wanted the commission's time and resources to be taken away from cases involving African Americans to cases involving women. So for the first year or year and a half, the commission didn't really implement the prohibition against sex discrimination in employment. And that was a very frustrating time for me.
Wow, I can imagine.
When I graduated from law school in 1957, 3% of this country's law school graduates were women. So you had a very small percentage of women lawyers in the country compared to male lawyers. The EEOC at that time did not have any jurisdiction to take cases to court.
So tell us a bit about your involvement with the National Organization for Women.
Well, I was working, as we've discussed, in the General Counsel's office of the EEOC, and I was very frustrated because, as I've also mentioned, the EEOC wasn't basically doing much with regard to discrimination against women for two reasons, basically. One, they didn't want the commission's resources diverted to women, and secondly, they really didn't know how to interpret the sex discrimination prohibitions of the Act because they raised many more difficult questions based on race and color, religion, and national origins. So this was a very frustrating situation for me. While I was there, Betty Friedan, who in 1963 had published her landmark book, The Feminine Mystique, came to the EOC. So Betty Friedan came to my office. She was going to interview, and did interview, I think, my boss, the general counsel, and the deputy general counsel. She thought she was going to write a book about the progress women had made since the publication of The Feminine Mystique. And she saw me there, a woman. So she came over to me and she said, what are the problems here? What are the conflicts? What's going on? And I felt that I couldn't level with her because I was working there. And if I told her what was going on with regard to women, I feared that I might lose my job. Mm-hmm. So I told her everything was just fine. So then she came a couple of weeks later again and saw me again. And it just so happened when she came, I was really frustrated about the failure to do anything for women. So I invited her into the privacy of my office, and I told her what was going on and that the commission wasn't really enforcing the law for women. And I told her that I thought what this country needed was an organization to fight for women like the NAACP fought for African Americans, although at that time I would have used the term Negroes. Mm-hmm. And that would have been in 65, 66. And then in June of 66 and October 66, NOW was formed.
So you've been involved for years. You've been able to see for yourself the difference in the legal industry for women. Considering the all these years that have passed since your involvement back in the 60s, What do you see is still missing in the legal field in terms of women and the involvement and the role women play within the law?
I don't see so much. I don't think of it in terms of the legal field. I'm generally asked as what do I see as the issues today mm-hmm. for all women. In the legal field, I left the law when I retired in 1993, and while I keep up to some extent, not a great deal as compared to my other current activities, so you'd really need to ask that question of somebody who's a practicing lawyer today. I can tell you what some of the issues are for women in the United States and worldwide, but not just with regard to women lawyers.
Okay, what would those issues be?
Well, first of all, we have the same problem. My daughter was born in 1972, and women with children who work have the same problems with regard to getting competent, affordable child care as we did then. This country has done nothing about child care, and we are the only industrial nation that doesn't provide paid maternity leave. So we really need to do something about child care for working families. That's a number one problem. Other problems are homelessness, women in poverty, hunger, violence against women is a tremendous problem, and maternal health care is a very big problem in this country. Another woman and I had a program in Sarasota last November on maternal health care and the maternal mortality rate. It's actually not very good in the United States, and we have many problems in that area that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's still work to be done.
Plenty.
If you were speaking to young women lawyers right now, what are some words that you would share with them in terms of basically getting the most out of their legal practice and standing up for themselves at any time that it's necessary?
Well, it depends what their interests are, who they are, if at all possible. If their interests are in that direction, I would recommend that they try to use the law to make the world a better place in which to live. Now, that's easier said than done, because very often these do-good jobs don't pay. But if one can both work in one's field and make the world a better place in which to live. For me, that's the ideal combination.
That's great. Is there any tip you would give in terms of creating a healthy work-life balance for women that are juggling between 10 things right now?
That's a toughie. I did it myself. And as I said, we still have the same problems in this country with no adequate child care facilities for people. That's really the key. Beyond that, I don't really have any tips for anybody. It's tough going.
It is. It's just all about persevering and prioritizing.
Right.
Sonia, it's been wonderful.
There's just so many hours in the day, and it's very hard to do.
That's right.
I guess it helps if one marries a supportive and helpful husband.
Exactly. So then your team members. It's been wonderful speaking with you today. Is there any website that our listeners can go to find out more about you or perhaps contact you?
Oh, yes. And they might want to read my memoir.
Yes.
My website is www.erraticimpact.com/Fuentes. And Erratic Impact is spelled ERRATICIMPACT. So it's erraticimpact.com/Fuentes. And my book is called Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter, and it's available from Amazon.com and my publisher, exlibris.com, which is spelled X-L-I-B-R-I-S.
Fantastic. That sounds like an incredibly interesting book. Thank
and
you very much.
Humor.
I'm sure it is.
You've been listening to the Lawyers Roundtable Show with host Sonia Gallagher. Visit Attorney Coach Gallagher at timeforlifenow.com to find ways to reach new levels of success and fulfillment from being a lawyer. Time for life. More clients, more profits, more free time while being a happier lawyer. Go to timeforlifenow.com.